Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the legislature overrides two of Governor Gary Herbert's vetoes. We learn which initiatives are likely to be on your ballot this November. And San Juan County claims a right-of-way through Recapture Canyon, site of a 2014 protest ATV ride. Joining me to talk about these and other stories, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Welcome, Dan.
Morning.
Public lands reporter Brian Maffley. Hi, Brian. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Roger. It's always good, man.
And news columnist Robert Gerke. Good morning to you, Robert.
Hey, good morning.
As always, listeners, you are invited to weigh in on the stories that we're covering today. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com, or you can call us. We are at 801-355-8255. Dan Harry, the Utah State Legislature called itself into a session this week, as it is currently allowed to do, for one very specific purpose, which is to override vetoes, if it so chooses. After the legislative session, Governor Gary Herbert used his veto pen on a couple of bills that lawmakers had passed. Lawmakers this week said, not so fast. So what are these two bills, and what's the background here, Dan? Because the context is that this is part of a broader power struggle in our state government, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's a power struggle between the governor, the executive branch, and the legislative branch. And they opened the legislative session this year with Greg Hughes, the House Speaker, saying that the legislature needed to improve its powers in relationship to the executive branch, that they're a part-time body, and so they kind of get walked over. So he said, you know, basically, we need to reclaim powers. So they did a couple of things. One of them was they allowed themselves to have their own attorneys represent the legislature when anyone challenges state law in court.
Okay.
Right now, the attorney general does that job. You know, that's part of his job, is to defend the state against lawsuits and challenges. And apparently, the legislature isn't happy with the job he's doing, although they're not specific about any particular cases. But they want to be able to have their own attorneys there. There is some constitutional question about whether they can do that. One of the hypotheticals is you'd have the attorney general taking one legal stand and the legislature another, and so then the court's left with deciding who actually represents the state.
I'm trying to, Dan, just to clarify here. Basically, the legislature, you know, passes a law. Let's say that it's I won't come up with a hypothetical. But then somebody challenges that law because maybe they say it clashes with the U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm. Normally, the attorney general's office would defend the law. Now, because of first off, this piece of legislation, and now the veto override, the legislature is going to also defend the law. And yeah, as you said, this is going to leave it in a judge's hands trying to determine who is actually representing the state?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And the governor quickly, after the legislature overrode his veto, you know, basically said, you know, we welcome the opportunity for this to be challenged in court. They think it's unconstitutional and that it'll be thrown out. The other bill was trying to force the attorney general to deliver a legal written opinion to the legislature when requested. And this goes back to last year when the AG wrote an opinion about Governor Herbert setting the rules for the special congressional election. The legislature had no say in it. They asked for a legal opinion. The AG prepared one but did not give it to the legislature, saying the governor has raised the attorney-client privilege issue, and so I can't give it to you, despite the fact that state law already says one of the basic duties of the attorney general is to provide a legal opinion when the legislature requests it. So they've tried to put in a place and mechanism where they can, like, if the similar situation happened, they could go straight to the Supreme Court and get an order for the attorney general to deliver such a legal opinion.
Why? It's just a sort of background question here, but why did the governor not want the legislature to see that opinion, or was it just a matter of saying who? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, we're not sure about that, because basically the AG sided with the governor's legal authority to set the rules as he did. So I think mainly it was an issue of precedent that the governor feels strongly that the AG is his attorney and shouldn't be giving advice to other parties, even the legislature, in legal matters where they may differ.
Okay, so this is another of the two bills that were overridden during this,
overridden probably is right.
Thanks, Dan. During this this veto override session, Robert Gerke, I want to bring your voice in on this as well as a columnist. The opinion, let's start with this last one that we were talking about, the legal opinion and forcing the Attorney General's office to provide a legal opinion to the legislature at their request. What came out of the legal opinion that was provided to the governor on that special election wasn't earth-shattering stuff. Mm-hmm. How big of a deal is this to you, Robert?
You know, it's a turf battle, and we've seen these turf battles going on for several years now between the governor and the legislature, and frankly, every time the legislature seems to win. So the governor's cloud is sort of being eroded pretty drastically over the last several years. But I don't think that this is going to be a huge issue. This is not an issue that had come up before where we'd had this sort of squabbling. I guess you can go back to the Jan Graham days when she and Mike Leavitt didn't necessarily see eye to eye on issues. But it's an infrequent occurrence. And so I don't know that it's going to have, from a practical standpoint, I don't know that it's going to have a major be a major issue.
Well, then on to the other one, SB 171. This one does seem to be more impactful because it allows the legislature to intervene in court challenges to laws that they pass. And I don't know, Robert Gerke or Dan Harry, was there a specific impetus here? Was there a law that lawmakers thought that the Attorney General's office wasn't defending well enough in court or choosing not to defend altogether? And yeah. So they said we're annoyed at that?
You know, I asked Senator Stuart Adams was the guy who sponsored this bill. And I asked him several times during the session what the impetus for it was, because it seems like it was something that had sort of a focus on it. It was directed in it, you know, towards something. But he said it wasn't. He said it was just, you know, we feel like we need to make sure that our views are represented when we go to court. During the debate on Wednesday, Representative Brad Daw raised one issue that he felt like that we didn't get adequate representation, and that was in 2013, I believe, they passed a bill that would require nonprofits to disclose their donors when they become politically active, you know, and that was considered to be, or a lot of people considered that to be, unconstitutional at the time it was passed. It was challenged in court, and the AG's office settled, basically dropping getting rid of the law, taking it off the books, because they felt like it was unconstitutional as well. So Brad Daw felt, at least, that that wasn't that the AG's office didn't adequately defend that law. The thing about it is like,
can I just jump in there?
Go ahead, Dan Harris.
So Greg Hughes specifically mentioned that bill too. I interviewed him the night of the governor vetoed those bills, and he specifically mentioned that bill. And I think Greg Hughes followed that legal battle very closely, and he said he was not happy with the way that the AG's office conducted that. And he said, no, this wasn't the reason for the bill. But it was pretty clear that he had some leftover dissatisfaction with the way that was handled.
Mm-hmm. Is it, I mean, the Attorney General's office might choose not to defend a law or not throw as much resources into defending a law if they see the writing on the wall, right? If they see that this is going to be struck down by the courts. Is that a possibility?
You know, Sean Reyes has said before in the past that he will defend any law passed by the legislature, whether he agrees with it personally or not. Mm-hmm. I think there have been instances maybe where they haven't necessarily been as vigorously pursued. There's been some frustration from the legislature toward the Attorney General's office that, for example, he hasn't filed a lawsuit against the opioid makers. That's a different thing. That's right. Not defending a law, but that's a more of an affirmative, prosecution of a case. But so I think, you know, I think the legislature wants to have its hands on the wheel. You know, during my column this week, I kind of drew a parallel to, you know, if the Highway Patrol stopped arresting as many people as the legislature thought they should, would the legislature go out and hire its own highway patrol troopers? And it seems like an absurd notion, but that's kind of exactly what they're doing here. The bill, as it's written, is very broad. It allows them to they, it allows them inter, a right to intervene, an unconditional right to intervene in any action, when any action of the legislature is challenged. And so that could mean, you know, a committee vote, that could mean a contract that has been, you know, let, that has, you know, for money that has been allocated by the legislature.
Very broad
appropriation. Yeah. It could be anything. And the governor pointed out in his veto letter, it could be thousands of instances. Senator Adams said that they don't have an intention or intent at this point to intervene in any lawsuits, but they are hiring, as Dan mentioned, they've allocated $700,000 for three full-time attorneys, a legal secretary, and a paralegal. So that's a lot of people to have sitting around just in case something happens. So it seems to me like they're going to, you know, they you know, bought this car and they're going to take it out for a spin.
Well, and that's what the governor's office, as Dan pointed out, that's what the governor's office wants them to do, and they want them to do it quickly so that they can challenge their ability to do that in the courts, essentially saying, go ahead, you know, try to intervene to defend a law and do it as quickly as you can so that when we challenge you, we can show you that this isn't going to fly.
It's kind of crazy, right? I mean, you're going to have a judge sitting in front of these two attorneys, one of them representing the legislature, one of them representing the AG's office, and potentially the governor's office, arguing about whether the legislature. It's going to be the AG who's going to be challenging the constitutionality of this bill, and it sets up a very interesting and convoluted dynamic. And if I'm a judge, you know, the way it's worked before, it's not just a separation of powers between the executive branch and the legislative branch, but the judicial branch has always had the right to determine who can intervene in a case, whether it's essential to have them in that case or not. And it takes away the judicial branch's right to, you know, have that control over who's intervening, who it's going to hear arguments from. So it's a problematic bill. And I was glad to see the governor vetoed it. They had also got overturned pretty easily. I think there were only 18 votes against it.
And it was pretty clear that it probably would be overturned, because if you look at the margins when it originally passed, mm-hmm. you know, it had veto-proof margins. There was some wavering there. I think they lost some votes. And they had to wait 10 minutes in the Senate for Margaret Dayton to come back from somewhere and to vote to override the veto there, or they didn't have enough votes without her.
It was interesting. Senator Wyler, Senator Bramble were two that were opposing this. That one of the issues that Senator Wyler raised, one of the things he pointed out was that the AG's office is already defending 35 constitutional challenges to state laws, which I think is more than I realized. There's a list of them. The other thing he said is that the legislature could lose some of its immunity. Right now, if you're challenging a law, you can't just, you know, make a legislature sit for legislator turn over documents related to that, or have a, you know, deposition. If they're a party to the case, they lose that immunity, and that opens them up to a whole host of things. And Representative Lowry Snow, during the debate on Wednesday, he's also an attorney, raised that issue, and I think was one of the reasons he voted against it.
Well, we'll see. The separation of powers issue is what Robert Grieco writes about in his column. Is it odd to have a Republican legislature and a Republican governor at loggerheads like this? I mean, I guess divisions will happen even in states where you've got a supermajority.
Well, that's exactly what's happened. I mean, we've had Republican governors and Republican controlled legislature now for, what, 30 years or more, and so they don't have an opposition party to fight with, basically. So, you know, they got to fight with somebody, right? and that's the most convenient way to fight. Sometimes it's the House fighting the Senate,
right.
But often now it's the executive branch versus the legislature. You know, basically that's the way our government's designed,
yeah.
Right? They're supposed to fight for power. That's why we have these three branches.
That was the point I was going to make. There's supposed to be this tension between the branches of government, and they don't always see eye to eye. But I do think when one branch is starting to take power from the other branches, and really our governor is, I mean, not just Governor Herbert, but the structure in the state, the governor is a pretty weak position when it comes to making laws. So, I think this just weakens him further.
Since we're on the topic of infighting, Robert, in your column this week, you also previewed the state GOP convention mm-hmm. taking place tomorrow. And it was sort of your column was sort of a heads up to Mitt Romney that this convention probably is not going to be a cakewalk.
Yeah, I pointed out, I guess, that You know, Mitt Romney's been around the block a few times. He ran for Senate in Massachusetts, ran for governor in Massachusetts. I think he ran for president, if I remember right.
I think a couple of times.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like that was something he did once. But I don't think he's ever been on a podium speaking against a guy who's impersonating Abe Lincoln as an opponent. This is the Utah convention, and it's a strange phenomenon. I don't know. We've seen in the past some opposition, to, you know, Governor Herbert didn't fare very well in the last Republican convention. We've seen Governor Leavitt in the past who got booed at the Republican convention. These delegates are not easily fall in line. And I think there's an anti-Romney undercurrent out there. And everybody kind of assumed that he was going to, you know, waltz in and, you know, flash a smile and kind of, you know, walk away with the nomination. I think he could have a little bit of problem. Now, I'm not saying he's going to lose. The question is, does he get the 60% he needs to capture the nomination without a primary fight? And what kind of reception, what kind of treatment does he get from the delegates? Because I think there is some, you know, there was a private delegate Facebook group that somebody shared with me that there was a lot of Mitt bashing in there. They feel like he feels like he's entitled to it, like he's from out of state. They feel like he's soft on, you know, there's the Romney care thing. They feel like he's soft on guns. They feel like he, you know, flip-flops on all of the issues. And there's, you know, so there's, they're not going to just, you know, jump on board the Mitt bandwagon just because it's the, you know, because he's Mighty Mitt.
Well, and there's also a rift in the Utah GOP over the Count My Vote deal that created the signature path to the ballot. Mm-hmm. Mitt Romney is gathering has gathered signatures. I'm going to quickly plug the KCPW program In the Hive that Emily Means tackled that rift on her show this week. So check it out, listeners. Romney's support for Count My Vote is maybe an additional liability in convention, right, Robert?
I think so, yeah. I mean, and his support is not just... It's not just a matter that he's gathering signatures. It's a question of in 2014, when Count My Vote was trying to get on the ballot, he endorsed Count My Vote and said that conventions are not representative of the broader public, and that he's been pushing to move toward direct primaries, and that he tried to. In typical Mitt Romney fashion, I guess, tried to downplay that, tried to waffle on it, and say he supported a dual track. But at the time when he was supporting Count My Vote, there wasn't a dual track in the bill. It was get rid of the conventions altogether and go just with direct primaries. So that will be a liability for him, because as we've seen, I mean, it's not universal opposition to the signature path, but it's substantial opposition to the signature path among these delegates.
Dan Harry, Robert. He also mentioned that opportunity for Mitt Romney, if he can get at least 60% of the delegates tomorrow, he doesn't have to go into a primary.
Right. And the reason that is because he's the only one who's gathered signatures and qualified to get on the ballot that way. Mm-hmm. And so all of the others are sticking to, you know, we're going to just do the convention route, mm-hmm. Or they filed to collect signatures and didn't make the threshold. But if he gets the 60%, that's it. No primary. And, you know, to Robert's point about this is going to be no cakewalk, I think Romney is a pretty smart guy, and he realizes that. He tweeted last night that I think he was making delegate phone calls up until 10 o'clock. So he's working this really hard. He's trying to sway delegates one at a time and in small groups, and he had an event at the Hale Center Theater where he had 600 people out, and, you know, he's working this very hard. I mean, there really is no way for him to lose. He's mm-hmm. he's going to at least get on the primary, but it would be embarrassing if he is not able to come out of this convention looking like the winner and the choice of the Republican insiders.
In Utah.
I have been impressed with how hard Mitt's campaigning. Because there was this perception that once he filed, we wouldn't see him again until November, right?
Well,
but
yeah.
He's been out, you know, very active.
He drove a tractor the very first day that he announced his candidacy.
And it's nice. It's nice that Mitt gets to see Utah for once.
Hey, I want to just jump in for one second. We have to go to a break, but another candidate who gathered signatures to get on the ballot is Representative John Curtis, who after only, five months in office, is now trying to retain his seat going through this convention. This is, you know, what I'm wondering is, will his having gathered signatures be a problem for him because he has the same candidate that he, the same likely
right.
opponent?
It's a rematch. Yeah. Chris Herod, the former state representative, is very, very conservative. And, you know, John Curtis got walloped last year in the convention, but it really it didn't matter in the end because, as this Count My Vote has often said, the convention delegates are not the same as Republican voters at large. They are much more ideological. They are much more conservative. And so, you know, John Curtis maybe again will face problems at the convention. He very well could. But he's going to be on the primary ballot at the very least. So
okay, you know. And that distinction between delegates and the rank and file GOP being a sort of deciding factor in the general election.
One interesting thing to watch, primary. I think, at the convention tomorrow is whether anybody brings up the John King thing. John King was the Provo police chief who now has been accused of by multiple women of sexual harassment and even some things that would cross the line into, you know, assault. And
what did Curtis know as
right
mayor?
And so it'll be interesting to see if anybody brings that up.
Okay. Dan Harry, government editor at the Salt Lake Tribune. We've got to head to our first break of the show. When we come back, we will turn to some public land stories from San Juan County. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, public lands reporter Brian Maffley, and news columnist Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning local news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255, or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. We're going to veer away from lawmaking for the moment and turn to a couple of stories out of San Juan County that public lands reporter Brian Maffley covered. And Brian, just to start with, let's go into Recapture Canyon, a place that we've heard about before.
Yeah.
It's a canyon that is replete with archaeological ruins and was also the site of a protest ATV ride, and it is a flashpoint once again. Why?
Well, for multiple reasons. It's also now being leased for oil and gas development, but that's a
okay.
Yeah. That was last week's story, not this week's story. What's happened now is like the San Juan County for years has wanted to reopen that canyon to motorized use. It was closed down 10 years ago, maybe more. By the BLM, under pressure from Great Old Broads for Wilderness and other groups to keep motorized use out because a trail that got built there without any authorization was damaging archaeological sites. And for years, the county has been working with the Bureau of Land Management to figure out a way to get it reopened and get motorized use back in there. They've obviously lost patience and now filed a lawsuit a couple months back asserting what's known as the RS-2477 claim to that canyon.
Right. And this is a right-of-way over the path that cuts through the canyon, saying essentially yeah. at one point it was or is now a road.
Yeah. So what they're saying is historically the San Juan County residents relied on that canyon as a transportation corridor. And under this law, revised statute 2477 from the 1860s, it essentially belongs to the county and the state of Utah. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is the county and the state have already asserted RS-2477 claims to hundreds of other routes in San Juan County, as many other counties have done.
Right.
And they never included Recapture Canyon in that collection of claims. So now they're kind of belatedly coming back and asserting a claim there after years of declining to do so. And so it's you know, and the state is not participating so far in this latest claim, which suggests to me that they don't have the evidence, a strong enough case to support such a claim. And we can get into this county's evidence in a minute.
Well, I would love to get into that because there's this history that that the lawsuit that is filed, and it's filed, as you said, individually, separate from the rest of these claims, is some newly uncovered history showing that this was used as a thoroughfare and the county saying that the Canyon Trail is actually a county road.
Yeah.
D-5314.
Oh, you remember the number.
Yeah, I've got it written down here.
Yeah.
And that it's been a road for a long time.
Sure.
Why does that history matter? I mean, they're trying to show evidence.
First of all, I don't, you know, calling it a road is really stressing the definition of that word.
Will you describe the canyon to us? Tell us.
Sure. That's a good idea. The canyon is immediately east of the town of Blanding, which is where all the biggest town in San Juan County. And it runs for about 7 miles south from Recapture Dam to what's known as the Perkins Road. And this is the part of Recapture Wash where it is, sunken into a canyon with sandstone walls on either side. And the Anasazi lived there 1,000 years ago and built these cliff dwellings into the sides of the canyon walls. There's archaeological sites all over the place. And unquestionably, historically, that canyon was a corridor for transportation. You know, this was before the invention of the automobile, obviously, and in modern times, it's no longer used as a transportation corridor. We have U.S. Highway 191 that runs about a mile to the west of that. You don't really need to drive through Recapture Canyon to get places. But what's happened is it became a very popular place for ATVing, and I can see why. It's a beautiful canyon. The trail that was illegally built there looks to me like a really fun trail to ride on, and it's also a very enjoyable trail to walk on, and I've done that several times. But the county is treating Recapture Canyon as kind of the line in the sand is, you know, we want to, this is an example of the federal government denying the local residents access to their own backyard, and we are going to fight tooth and nail and spend thousands of dollars to accomplish that goal.
It speaks to the sort of emblematic position that Recapture Canyon has taken in the struggle around public lands in Utah. And I want to bring Robert Gerke in on this. San Juan County Commissioner Phil Lyman made a name for himself because of this protest ATV ride in Recapture Canyon in 2014.
Yeah.
He spent 10 days in jail over that action. I actually don't know how to throw this to you. Given that back and forth, Recapture Canyon is a place that is this flashpoint. Actually, Recapture seems like a really fitting name for the canyon
that they want to recapture it, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, it is. There are a few flashpoints, I think, for this roads debate that's been going on. I'll tell you, when I first started in journalism, one of the first stories I ever had to write about was about the Burr Trail, which was a similar argument about RS-2477 roads. This fight's been going on for quarter century and probably will go on for another quarter century. I mean, it's been going on for more than a quarter century, but probably will continue for years to come. Recapture, Salt Creek, you know, Burr Trail, these are sort of flashpoints in this debate. Again, as Brian points out, the state has kind of kept its hands off on this one, and they've been very aggressive on others, so it would indicate that they probably don't see the case is a compelling one, but San Juan County certainly isn't going to give this one up without a fight.
I quickly want to turn to other stories after in a moment, but does the fact that does the change at say the Department of the Interior, who's in charge there, play into this and why San Juan County is filing this new claim now? Does that even matter?
I don't really think it does.
Okay.
Who defends this claim is the solicitor, U.S. Solicitor's Office, not the Bureau of Land Management,
right.
And they could very well decide to aggressively fight this claim. Now they filed papers this week asking for a 60-day extension to respond to the lawsuit, and it's clear that they want to determine whether to just include it into the existing San Juan County lawsuit that was filed like 6 years ago, and has been sitting there in court while They work on other counties, like Kane and Garfield counties, RS-2477. What I think the state is and the feds are trying to accomplish now is let's take care of a couple counties, RS-2477 cases first, and then we'll figure out how things are going to settle out and mm-hmm. negotiate a settlement on the rest of them. That's kind of how this is playing out.
In those RS-2477 claims that are being adjudicated, solved,
yeah.
are they saying, okay, this one actually is a road, this one's not a road, and defining it that way so that you...
It's not whether it's a road or whether it's not a road. It's whether the route was... used for 10 continuous years, open to the public prior to 1976 when the law... So whether it's a road now is irrelevant.
Okay.
So what's going on with Recapture Canyon was they have these maps, these U.S. Army maps that indicate a road there, some documents from the county saying they've established a road there back in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. They've spent money maintaining it. They also, this seems like the thinnest of evidence, but they cite a magazine article from 1903 that refers to it as well-traveled, quote unquote. Is that evidence that the road was open to the public in continuous use for 10 straight years? I don't think that's going to be tough to hold up.
When Phil Lyman had his protest ATV ride there in Recapture Canyon, it was framed as a sort of act of civil disobedience. After he was convicted of conspiracy charges to reinforce that civil disobedience idea, his supporters even made T-shirts that had his face next to Rosa Parks and Gandhi and Chief Joseph.
Yeah.
Brian Maffley, civil disobedience is something that is more commonly associated with environmental activists. And I want to turn...
And civil rights.
Now, and of course, civil rights. But I want to turn to another case, another criminal case from San Juan County having to do with public lands. It's the story of a couple, Mark Franklin and Rose Chilcote?
Chilcote, yes.
Okay. And the criminal charges against them. This story starts on April Fool's Day of last year. Maybe you can walk us through what they did and what's happening to them now.
Yeah, so for background, Rose Chilcote was formerly a leader of the group Great Old Broster Wilderness and, by the way, was very instrumental in getting the BLM to close motorized use in Recapture Canyon, and pressuring the BLM to go after Phil Lyman too. I might add. So she's now being prosecuted for trying to kill a rancher's cattle in San Juan County, allegedly. And it's been many people think that she's being unfairly targeted. So what happened on April 1st of last year was her husband. She and her husband were on their way to Valley of the Gods. At least Mark stopped. We don't know if Rose was in the car or not, but Mark stopped by a corral owned by a rancher whose name's Zane Odell. And while checking it out, he closed the gate to the corral. That apparently really... later really ticked off the rancher who claimed it was closing the gate was keeping his cattle from reaching their water source inside the corral. And I visited it myself. There's a well there and the cows need to get in there to get water.
And so the intent was to keep the cattle away from the water to essentially do them harm, kill them.
Yes.
That's what he says.
That's what the county is now alleging in a felony complaint against Chilcote and Franklin.
What did they say?
They say, well, first of all, the corral fence was down so the cows could come and go freely. But how the criminal case came about was a couple days later, the couple are driving back home to Durango, Colorado. And the rancher and a couple cowboys confront them, recognize their vehicle from a trail cam they had mounted on the gate. And at that point, Mark Franklin openly admitted, I closed the gate and and denied that he had any intentions of hurting the cattle. And law enforcement was summoned, and they took their statements, and they went home. Everything they thought everything was fine, and then a week later, the San Juan County attorney filed a number of criminal charges against both of them, both Rose and Mark.
And they're being hit with felony charges for closing this gate.
Yeah, it's a second degree felony, attempted. I can't even remember the name of the charge, but it's attempted destruction of livestock.
Yeah. We've gone over the tensions in San Juan County and the role that you mentioned that Rose played as head of the Great Old Broads for Wilderness, an environmental group. There's a law professor who's weighing in on this case on the couple's behalf. This is a University of Utah law professor. He sees some problems with this case and with these charges. Tell us what he's doing.
Well, this is Paul Cassell, who's a former prosecutor and also served several years on the federal bench. He has been retained by the couple and has filed a motion to quash the bindover. It's basically a motion to dismiss the case, arguing that the county attorney in San Juan County is basically criminalizing conduct that, you know, Rose Chilcote is entitled to do as a citizen of the United States. A, you know, freely associate with people with the same political feelings as she does. But also for expressing herself, because they filed there's a second charge filed against Rose Chilcote for it's a felony for retaliating against a witness, and that was filed a few weeks after the initial case. And that charge was based on Rose filing a complaint with the BLM alleging that Zane O'Dell was. Its operation was damaging the environment, and he was conducting ground-disturbing activities that exceeded the scope of his permit. Mm. So the county attorney is now claiming that act was intended to retaliate against Zane's complaint. So that's a further felony. And so Paul Cassell saying Rose is entitled to file such a complaint as a citizen.
He's saying that essentially San Juan County is trying to stick it to an environmentalist just because of the positions that she holds. What does San Juan County say to the idea that they are targeting
her? Yeah, but there's more to it than that, okay, Roger. He's also saying that the basis for the claiming Rose is guilty is that she is an environmentalist. They don't have any evidence. There is really no evidence that Rose or Mark, for that matter, were trying to kill cattle. The evidence for that is that Rose is an environmentalist. Mm. So Cassell saying that is not the basis for a criminal prosecution.
Robert Gerke, I want to bring you in on this. I know it's kind of hard to talk about specific court cases.
I love this story, by the way. I thought this was fascinating. I thought this was just, I mean, it just kind of paints a picture of how things operate in San Juan County, doesn't it?
Are these felony charges appropriate? I mean, does this seem, how do you view this, Robert Gerke, columnist?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, in any criminal case, especially a felony case, you have to show there was intent to violate the law in most instances. And it's hard to prove, it's hard to show that they closed the gate with an intent to kill the cattle, especially when, correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, but he could see that the fence was down when he closed the gate, right?
This is disputed, though, right?
Yeah, the prosecutor is alleging that there's no way Mark Franklin could have known that the gate was down.
The fence was down.
Yeah. The fence was down. Yeah.
So, you know, so it's hard for me to believe that if I had stopped by and saw, oh, well, this gate to the corral's open, I should probably close it to help this rancher out. I doubt that maybe I would be charged. But if Roger, if you went down
there, you most certainly would be charged.
They're not fans of me in San Juan County either, but probably not as much as this couple. It seems like it's politically motivated, and it seems like, you know, and when you have somebody of Paul Cassell's stature, and he's not, you know, he's a conservative, a very conservative, was a conservative judge and prosecutor, but you have him getting involved to help out some environmentalists. You can see that, at least from his perspective, and he makes a pretty compelling case that this is a politically motivated prosecution.
We're low on time, but I want to actually talk for a moment about politics in San Juan County before we head to a break. San Juan County has this commission form of government. Because of court-mandated redistricting, the makeup of the commission is likely to change. Is that going to affect whether or not San Juan County decides to pursue cases like this one or for that matter, Brian Maffley, the road right-of-way claims and so on? Are we about to see a sort of overhaul of what San Juan County does?
Well, I think if they elect a Navajo majority county commission, we'll see some change in priorities. Whether or not they prosecute people like Rose Chilcote, I mean, that's up to the county attorney, not the county commission.
Okay, Dan Harry, also on the same or in the same ambit, there one of the candidates who's filed for those elections in San Juan County his candidacy is being challenged by San Juan County, I believe. Correct?
Yeah, that's right. And this is an extremely rare instance where the county clerk and now the county commission also is involved in an investigation, and it looks like it could be a criminal investigation of the Democratic nominee in one of the commission seats.
This is Willie Grayeyes.
Yeah, Willie Grayeyes, who is a prominent figure in backing – he's a Navajo. He's a Democrat, and he's a prominent figure in backing the Bears Ears National Monument, which, you know, the power structure in San Juan County has opposed from the get-go. And all of a sudden now they're accusing him of not being a resident of San Juan County and therefore ineligible to run. Moreover, that if he did this on purpose and lied in the candidate filings that he submitted, that he could be criminally charged. And, this is an election that's happening because a federal court came in and looked at it and said that this is a violation of the Voting Rights Act, that you have a majority population Navajo in San Juan County, and the way that the districts were drawn, they pack them and stack them. So they have one district that is like 93% Navajo, and then the other two, the Navajos are a minority in those districts. So what the court has said is you can't do that. That's a racially based gerrymandering, and we're going to come in and draw the districts because you won't do it. So he had a California professor draw the districts, and now under the new districts that will be voted on this November, Navajos will hold the majority in two of those districts, and there are three county commissioners. So, as Brian says, if Navajos and Democrats take over two of those three seats, then you will have Democratic control in one of the most conservative, what we've seen as one of the most conservative counties in the state.
If the Democratic nominee Willie Grayeyes' candidacy is seen as if he is charged with if he's taken out of that race, is there anybody to replace him?
We're a long way from that.
Okay.
The Democrats and Willie Grayeyes himself strongly disputes the fact that he's not a resident of San Juan County. State voting records. I talked to the state elections director yesterday. The state records go back to '92 that he could access, Justin Lee. And he said that Willie Grayeyes has voted in every general election dating back to at least 1992, with the exception of one year, 1996. Mm-hmm. So, he's been a member of the Utah Navajo Commission, which requires Utah residency.
Where do they say he lives?
They say that he lives in Arizona.
Okay.
And he's got an attorney now, and they faxed them or emailed them yesterday to the county maps saying this is where Willie Grayeyes lives, and it's clearly in the Utah side of the reservation.
His attorney said yesterday that he sent them Google Earth images of his house.
Yeah.
Like, here's his house, here's his truck, and they said that the sheriff's deputy who conducted they put investigation in quotes, wasn't able to find the house.
Yeah, because what the county demanded was that Willie Grayeyes come into the county courthouse in Monticello and prove that he's a resident. Now, that doesn't seem the way our system works, right? If you're accusing someone of something, you have the burden of proof, not the person who you're accusing.
Yeah. Has a birtherism feel to it, kind of.
It does have some.
Well, one of the sources of confusion there is a lot of Navajo who live in the county have P.O. boxes in Arizona.
Right.
That's the closest place for them to get mail. And that's apparently the case with Willie Grayeyes, mm-hmm. who lives on Navajo Mountain.
Difficult to access as well. Yeah. Guys, we have to go to a break. I'm sorry, we're low on time in the show, but Yeah, when we come back, we're going to try and tackle a little bit of the ballot initiatives that we're likely to see on the November ballot. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Brian Maffley, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. Dan Harry, government editor, in the few minutes remaining, let's talk about the initiatives that appear to have gathered enough signatures to make it onto the November ballot. And I guess the question is, what are the initiatives that we are likely to be voting on?
Right. And we should have that cautionary note that they haven't been certified yet. So yeah, we're basing this on the number of signatures that were submitted. And, you know, you'll always have some of those thrown out. But it looks like the ones that will qualify for the ballot, the November 6th ballot that we'll all be voting on, is medical marijuana, a broad-based medical marijuana legalization, much more sweeping than the narrow bills that were passed in the legislature.
A sort of right to try for end-of-life.
That's what the state version does, but the initiative does much more. It allows folks to use medical marijuana for chronic pain and a number of diseases and ailments. We also have full expansion of Medicaid, which is estimated to cover about 150,000 low-income folks. That compares to about 72,000 that are covered by what the legislature passed. Mm-hmm. We have the Count My Vote, which is the dual path, the signature-gathering path to the ballot that we've been talking about.
Isn't that already law?
It is law, but the legislature keeps attacking it both in the legislature and in courts. And so the folks who are behind this wanted a vote of the people to once and for all say, this is what the public wants, hands off. They also are going to lower the threshold of signatures required, so it would become easier to get on the ballot for candidates. And then finally, we have what they call the Better Boundaries Initiative, which is an attempt to push back the suspected gerrymandering in the state of voting districts. We now have, you know, four House districts in the state of Utah, congressional districts. The most populous county, Salt Lake County, does not have a single representative living inside it, and that's because of the way that the legislature has drawn the laws, the voting districts.
And so this would create a...
This would create an independent commission, which by constitution could not actually set the boundaries, but what it would do is recommend the boundaries. Those would go to legislature, and then they could vote them up or down. They could not amend them.
Mm. You know, it's probably going to take a lot of money to get. It's taken a lot of money to get to this point so far. Robert Gerke actually wrote about this in his column to get these initiatives to where they are. I'm imagining we'll see a lot of ads, PR campaigns, and a lot more from both those who are for and against these initiatives in the run-up to November election. I think we're going to have to leave it there, though, because we are out of time, and turn now to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. Who wants to start? Dan Harry?
I'll talk about UTA. There's been a lot of interesting developments in the UTA story this week. It's going under a major restructuring. And the other day, the board announced that it would fire Jerry Benson, not for performance. They said he's a great guy and has done a great job. They wish him well, but they say the law that the legislature passed eliminates the CEO and president position so that they had to fire him. The legislators who sponsored that law said, we don't know what you're talking about. You don't have to fire him. We've created an interim directorship, and we expected and assumed that Jerry Benson would take that. So once again, there's a tension between the legislature and UTA that just doesn't seem to end.
Hmm. Okay, that's an interesting underplayed story. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story.
This is one that I'm excited about, but the owners of the Stateroom, Chris Motz and his partner, are going to be opening a new venue, a new concert venue, in June. It's going to be twice the size of the Stateroom. The idea is that they're going to be able to get some bigger acts through there.
Sounds
and so if you're a big fan of live music in the city, it's going to be I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be a good venue, better than the other sort of comparably sized venues, and it'll probably attract some big names.
All right, some good news for concert goers from Robert Gerke. Brian Maffley, your pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, well, we've already talked about it, but it's Courtney Tanner's story in today's paper about the investigation of Willie Gray Eyes' eligibility to be a candidate. I really think that's going to be an explosive story.
Wonderful.
That could really, blow back on the county if they're not careful.
Something to definitely keep an eye on. For my part, I'm going to go with after the dramatic emergency landing of the Southwest flight, where an engine exploded and it resulted in a death, a lot of us started freaking out about air travel. Forbes, though, published a reality check with some odds for you to consider. Your odds of dying in a coast-to-coast road trip in your car are 1 in 14,000. In a tornado, 1 in 450,000. Getting struck by lightning, 1 in 1.9 million. And in a U.S. commercial jet airline accident, 1 in 7 million. So statistically, you're way more likely to be injured in, say, a car.
So you're saying there's a chance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Forbes also says that that your chance of dying from heart disease is 1 in 2. So there's that to consider as well. I mean, I don't
know.
Great,
thanks.
Yeah. Dan Harry, Brian Maffley, Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, you guys, very much for being here today.
Thanks. Have a good
thanks.
Weekend.
Thanks, Roger.
And that does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. We have some people to thank here. Jesse Ellis at KCPW. Our partners in at Utah Public Radio and Logan include Tom Williams, Alyssa Roberts, and Spencer Halsey. And thanks as well to the show's producer, Emily Means. Search for Behind the Headlines in your podcast app to find podcasts of this show, or you can find them at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for tuning in, and we will see you next week.